Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 141. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two Marlene Dietrich westerns. First off, from 1939, we have Destry Rides Again, starring Marlene Dietrich, of course, James Stewart and Misha Auer. Then we're going to go to 1952 to take a look at Rancho Notorious, the Fritz Lang movie, also starring Arthur Kennedy and Mel Ferrer. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show after I do the contact details and the credits. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved. And if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema. Hi, how's everybody doing? We're doing pretty okay here. The winter is still there, and it's been quite a wet winter as well. So if I bump things now, you can hear them a lot. And that's a problem. I'm going to have to be a little careful with my gestures because thanks to the Patreon campaign, I got my first piece of equipment for the podcast. Well, the first new piece of equipment anyway, which is a Blue Yeti microphone. It's a desktop microphone which plugs into the USB port. And excuse me if I do go into a bit of tech porn here. And it's about a foot tall, weighs about 3 kilos, so it's a hefty little bastard. It also has a number of different modes, so I can do things like have everybody around a table. If I ever bother getting everybody around a table to do a podcast, everybody can be heard by the microphone. Or I can just do it me and a person opposite me. There are a whole bunch of different modes on it. I was going to buy the software, the Dragon EasySpeak software, natural speak software, sorry, for the podcast, but I'm still checking out whether it's going to do what I want it to do. I've got to do a little bit more research for that. So when the money came in, I decided what I would do is get a microphone. I've been looking at blue microphones. I did have a blue snowball at one stage, but it never quite worked right for the computer gear I had. So this time around, I decided to do my research. So I did a bit of homework. And the Blue Yeti is the microphone I'm going to be using. I hope the sound quality comes out okay. It's a very sensitive little instrument, and you will get a whole bunch of external noise. Like, for instance, if I rub my fingers together here, you can hear it. That's how sensitive the microphone is. And it does give me also the luxury of being able to sit back a little bit while I'm podcasting. Normally I use a headset mic, but they've been a bit problematic at times, and you can get a bit too much of my breathing in it. So I went with this one, and it is great. And a good thing about it, too, is it's a big microphone. And if I want to put it away, all I've got to do is just put a sock over it and stick it over in a corner. So it stores very easily. And by the way, thank you to everybody who donated to the Patreon campaign so far to enable me to have this really terrific piece of tech pornography microphone with which to tell you about the movies. And I should really talk about the movies that I'm doing this time around. For no apparent reason, I'm doing 2 Marlene Dietrich westerns. She didn't do that many, but these are 2 of the best. The first one's from 1939, was directed by George Marshall and also stars James Stewart and Misha Auer, and it is Destry Rides Again, very, very loosely based on a novel by Max Brand. The second one's from 1952, directed by Fritz Lang, and it is Rancho Notorious, which is interesting for a few different reasons. I think I prefer the first to the second one, but doing these two westerns which star Marlene Dietrich gives me an opportunity to talk a little bit about sexual politics that's in there and why I think Marlene Dietrich in some ways got a bit of a rough trot from Hollywood because of the way women in society were viewed at the time these movies were being made. But before I get into that, I'll talk a little bit about the movies I've watched since last I talked at you. I did watch all of The Grand Budapest Hotel, and I recommend it highly. Ralph Fiennes isn't an actor that I've particularly liked in the past, but in this one he is superb. The ensemble's good there. There are so many great actors in little tiny roles. If you haven't seen it, just go with the ride. I did find out after watching the movie that it was inspired by the writings of Stefan Zweig. Stefan Zweig was the guy who wrote a movie I talked about a few podcasts ago, which was Letter from an Unknown Woman. So I found that an extra interesting piece of the puzzle that is our love of cinema. I saw Trailer Park Boys, Don't Legalize It, because I've kind of got this thing for Trailer Park Boys. It was on YouTube, so I watched it. It's basically another stoner comedy based on the TV series Trailer Park Boys from Canada. Let's see. Liz and I did a movie for the radio. We had a week we skipped because the stupid football was on instead of her talking movies with me. So we went with a 2001 Australian film, which I really recommend that people do check out because it's a fine story and it really does hit a whole bunch of interesting emotional beats. And that is Lantana, starring Anthony LaPaglia. It's also got Geoffrey Rush in it, Kerry Armstrong, and a bunch of other Australian actors. A really fine little mystery movie, not a murder mystery, but a mystery movie, which also talks about relationships and things like that. So we had a lot of fun digging into that one, and both of us enjoyed it, and we took different things from it, which is a lovely thing about doing the radio gig with somebody of the other gender, that they don't see things the way I do necessarily, and I learn things by listening to what Liz has to say about the movies as well. And that's a lot of fun for me. Next week we're going to go really lowbrow and do one of my favourite, not quite guilty pleasure movies from last 10 years, and that's Step Brothers with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. So we're going to have a bit of fun and do that. I did see one of the DC animated movies, Batman Assault on Arkham, which is really good. I enjoyed that a lot. DC Animation is doing some great films, and that one was of interest. Now, because I did Destry Rides Again, I actually got it in a six-pack of James Stewart westerns that I picked up at a supermarket for like $20 for six movies. Not a bad deal, so I picked it up there. And so I went through a few of the other movies besides Destry Rides Again that were on in the six-pack. I watched three other ones, which were The Far Country, which is another Anthony Mann Western that James Stewart did, The Rare Breed and Bend of the River. So two of those, The Far Country and Bend of the River, were Anthony Mann Westerns. The other one was a 1966 one about cow breeding, which wasn't that good, The Rare Breed. Though it does have a really interesting scene-stealing role with Brian Keith playing a Scottish cattle baron. But anyway, Bend in the River and The Far Country were a lot of fun, very similar in a lot of ways. I made a couple of years apart, had a lot of the same actors in them. But they were kind of cool and not too shabby. I've been really getting into, though, just to get away from Westerns for a sec, been really getting into watching old TV series on YouTube. And there's a thing called Craft Suspense Theatre. If you do look that up on YouTube, they're these 45-minute dramas which are in the suspense genre. None of them are linked in together. None of them are particularly have the same actors in them, though you do see actors recurring in different roles in the thing as they build up a stable of actors for this series. But there have been some really good ones. There's a one of the things in the Craft Suspense Theatre, there was a kind of Most Dangerous Game iteration where Mickey Rooney is playing a Southern sheriff who basically hunts down people. And the guy he decides to hunt down in this particular story is none other than a very young James Caan. And it's also got Bruce Dern in it as well and a few other people. So it's kind of weird and interesting who turns up in these little episodic dramas. So I've been watching a bit of that. I've also been watching the TV series that gives me the theme at the start of this podcast, which is a 1959 one season kind of crime drama series starring Mike Connors called Tightrope. And that's kind of interesting too, because it's a half an hour drama series about an undercover cop. And the plotting and everything has to be so tight to fit into that half an hour format. It's actually a little less than half an hour because they have to allow for commercials. But seeing something like that that fits into a half-hour format, you know, you can eat them like popcorn. You just put aside a half an hour or 25 minutes, whatever it is, and watch these late 1950s. They're almost like little pocket films noir. And they're a bit of fun. Occasionally interesting character actors turn up in them. I've watched about three of those so far, and they suck up so much of your time if you let them to, because you just keep adding them to your watch later list. And when you've got a few minutes to spare, just sit down and watch an episode and get away with it. So there's so much old TV now from the middle of the last century that's available on YouTube. Whether it's legitimate or not, I don't know, but it's on YouTube, and so I can access it through the Chromecast. And they're worth just kind of noodling around there, seeing what you can find. It's one of those things where your best bet is to randomly search. Or if you've got a particular TV series in mind, try popping it in. You may get one or two episodes of that series. But the little thing down the right-hand side of the screen will give you episodes to other TV series that you might find interesting. And, it really is a time waster if you let it be. Though watching old stuff's never a waste of time, as we all know. Anyway, that's about it for what I've been watching. Nothing particularly deep or brilliant apart from Lantana. But what I'm going to do now is take a small break, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about Destry Rides again, because we always do the movies for these podcasts in chronological order.
Trip's almost over. I don't mind the bumps.
Well, I do. Don't take it easy. I'll blow his head off.
Please don't mind my brother, Mr. Destry. He's always threatening to blow people's heads off.
I had a friend once. His name was Stubbs. He was always going around threatening to blow people's heads off. One day a fella came along and took him up on it.
Well,
folks say that now Stubbs' forehead is holding up the prettiest tombstone in Greenlawn Cemetery.
Very funny. You know, I've been handling cattle around these parts for quite a spell. I've met some of the toughest hombres they got.
I'm still here.
This ain't no ornament.
Pretty good with it.
So is Stubbs.
You mean it just exactly what?
Well, I just mean you got to be careful who you meet up with.
Well, you got some pretty peculiar ideas for a deputy sheriff.
But they make sense.
Oh, so I'm supposed to ride in this confounded contraption getting bumped around like this and grin like a baboon.
Well, maybe you should take up a hobby like me. You'd be surprised the genuine rage you can work off just by carving a little piece of wood like that.
Are you sure your name is Destry?
Yeah. Folks is always asking me that. Oh, I beg your pardon.
Okay, that brings us to 1939's Destry Rides Again. I'll give you the IMDb précis of this one, and we'll move on from there. Kent, played by Brian Dunleavy, the unscrupulous boss of Bottleneck, has Sheriff Keogh killed when he asks one too many questions about a rigged poker game that gives Kent a stranglehold over the local cattle ranches. The mayor, who is in cahoots with Kent, appoints the town drunk Washington Dimmesdale as the new sheriff, assuming that he'll be easy to control. But what the mayor doesn't know is that Dimmesdale was a deputy sheriff under the famous lawman Tom Destry, and is able to call upon the equally formidable Tom Destry Jr. to be his deputy. It says here, featuring a career-reviving performance from Marlene Dietrich as the bar singer Frenchie, which could well have been the inspiration for Madeline Kahn's Blazing Saddles character, Lily von Stupp. Well, there's no, it could be in that. It's definitely the model for Lily von Stupp in Blazing Saddles. Right from the very start, the movie pre-positions itself as a comedy. If you have a look at the titles, behind the titles, there's a, it's kind of a street fight that turns into a bar fight that's going on in the background. And it's so over the top, almost a pantomime of cowboy movie bar fights, that the, even subconsciously, if you don't really recognize it, you, the movie does set you up to think, yes, this is going to be a comedy, yes, this is going to be a bit absurd, and it's not to be taken seriously. And that's kind of cool too. It's not something that really, really, really draws attention to itself, but it's something that's there and kind of does work things out well. Now, helping Kent to con all of the cattle ranchers out of their money in these poker games is Frenchie, played by Marlene Dietrich. At the time, Marlene Dietrich, as it says in the praise there, her career was on a bit of a down. She'd done Garden of Valor with Charles Boyer. It had been a big bomb. And after her initial success in the early 1930s, she was kind of a fading star in some ways. But this one really does pick it up. She has a forthrightness and an outright sense of fun and plays the comedy very, very well. And people weren't particularly aware that she could do comedy at the time, but in this movie she really did do it and had a great time with it. The movie, of course, is also enhanced by the fact that her and James Stewart have a great rapport in the film. There's a great chemistry between them when Tom Destry does meet Frenchie, and I'll just play a little bit of audio from that to give you a bit of an idea of that.
Oh, Frenchie! Frenchie! Oh, here's the gal you got to meet. Come on! This is Frenchie.
Howdy, ma'am.
How's the weather up there?
Yeah. Hi, come on. You can do better than that.
You know, Frenchie is the real boss of Bottleneck.
Oh, well, I always like to know who's boss.
You'll find out.
And there's also a good bit with Misha Owl, another one of those European emigre actors who came out to escape the Nazis, and Marlene Dietrich, where he's gambling with her to win some money. And I'm going to play that. I'm going to indulge myself a little bit and just play that bit because it is really funny, and I do like the way that Marlene Dietrich teases him into making a bad move.
How much have you got left? Tap your Callahan.
Please, Frenchie, I am not Callahan. Callahan was my wife's first husband, and he's dead. I am Boris Alexandrovich Stavrogin, and I'd like to be called by my name.
All right, Callahan, what do you do?
Deal.
King, ace, can you beat it?
Is my credit good?
No, not this time.
Oh, please, Frenchie.
Still want to bet, huh?
Uh-huh.
All right. $30 against your pants.
My pants? Oh, no. $30, huh? Mm-hmm. My pants. $30. I'll be right back, Frenchie.
Oh, I won't be here then.
Oh, then we can go all wrong.
No. You make up your mind right now.
Oh, what to do? If I leave, I probably could have won the pot. And if I stay, I might lose it. And if I don't go and help with the baggage, my wife will skin me alive.
Oh, your wife will skin you alive anyway. Come on, maybe you've got me beat.
Ah, I've been waiting for you to tell me I've got you beat, so I would think I have not got you beat. But I personally know I have got you beat with my two kings against your lonely ace. Haven't I, Frenchie?
$30 against your pants.
Oh, what to do? Два короля, один туз. Даже если другой туз, да, может быть, и нет. Но если нет, о. Frenchie, have I got you beat?
Why don't you call me and find out?
I'll call. I'll bet my pants.
Two aces.
I was right. Why didn't I listen to myself?
Hand over those pants.
Oh, but little Frenchie, I can't. It's undignified. Think of my position. I've met every king in Europe.
Now you met two aces in Bottleneck. Off with those pants.
No, little Frenchie, really don't mean
it. Get them, get them.
Those clips demonstrate a couple of things. First one is that Frenchie's a woman who lives life on her own terms and can meet men eye to eye and get and best them by basically being charming and smart and funny. And it also shows that nice rapport that you've got between Jimmy Stewart and Marlene Dietrich, who had an affair during the making of this film. Some stories say that she became pregnant as well and had a termination of the pregnancy, But that, again, is something you're never really going to prove one way or the other. But the rapport is there, definitely, and the flirtatiousness is there, and it really does lift the movie wonderfully. There are a few other people in the movie that are quite interesting, too. There's a fight between Callahan's wife, played by Una Merkel, and Frenchie. Callahan's wife's called Lilybell. And basically, they do roll around, they fall off tables, they bash each other, they tear each other's hair, they do all sorts of stuff. And it's not done by stunt performers, it's actually done by Marlene Dietrich and Una Merkel. And both of them got bruised up pretty badly making that part. And it's one of those first times in that I know of in a movie history where two women are having a fight and all the guys stop to watch. They do rip each other's clothing to a certain extent within the limitations of the time. And it's, yeah, it's quite an interesting little scene. You've got other people in there. You've got Billy Gilbert, an actor who had been acting since Silent Days, playing Loup Garou, the bartender. You got Don Levy, as I said. You got Charles Winnegar playing Washington Dimmesdale, the town drunk who becomes a sober and upright sheriff. And he's a lot of fun in there as well. As I said, you've got Brian Donlevy, who people remember played Quatermass in the first couple of Quatermass movies in the 1950s. And you've got little character actors like Alan Jenkins in there, and Jack Carson turns up, who's normally considered a light actor. He's playing a little bit of a heavier role as Jack Tindall, the cattle rancher, who is one of the people who goes up against Kent, played by Brian Donlevy. But yeah, the movie is a lot of fun for a number of reasons, but I keep coming back to the fact that A, you've got a sheriff who doesn't use a gun but uses his smarts, and that's quite an interesting thing. He calms himself down by carving napkin rings out of wood, and he plays against all of those Western stereotypes in a really interesting way, and which of course does again influence Blazing Saddles, where you've got Bart the Black Sheriff playing against the stereotypes of this time, and in some ways not really using his guns very much to win the day. But the movie, as I said, varies a lot from the original book by Max Brand, which is done very much more seriously. But we're coming back to Marlene Dietrich too. I'm going to do a little bit of spoiler on this just to demonstrate a point that I want to make. But Frenchie doesn't live to the end of the movie because she's a bar girl. She lived with Kent. There's the very strong indications that they had some form of a relationship and a liaison before she meets Tom Destry and falls in love with him. And according to the Hays Code, which was strangling movies at the time, that sort of woman doesn't get to get the guy at the end of the movie. There are a lot of limitations on that. So she gets shot protecting Destry. And that pissed me off a lot. The more I look into old films, and the more I understand the Hays Code, and the more I understand the political, religious, and moral, in inverted commas, reasons why that policy was put in place, the more it pisses me off. Because I think that with such a charismatic character as Frenchie, and who plays really well against the kind of laconic and easygoing but very smart Tom Destry, played by James Stewart, she deserves to prevail in some ways and not just be a way of the hero surviving until the end credits. I think that one of the things that there are two ways the guys, well, straight guys, we'll assume straight guys for the sake of argument. There are two ways that straight guys can react to strong, confident women. One of which is to kind of admire it and find an attractive trait in another person. The other one is to feel threatened by it. And I think that Hollywood, in general, at the time, was threatened by strong, confident women in movies, even though they were popular at the box office in a lot of ways. You have a look at a lot of the roles that Katharine Hepburn did, and Marlene Dietrich did, and people like Barbara Stanwyck did, and Joan Crawford in Johnny Guitar, and those sorts of things. All of those kind of women have to be brought down a peg or two if they survive at all to the end of the movie. And that kind of pisses me off about this time. I don't think it's something that I think the movie would have played out a lot differently without the Hays Code, and I think that there was a sophistication in the people who were making movies in Hollywood at the time to realise that they had to water it down. And if you look back through the memos at the time, there are a lot of arguments that went back and forth between the Hays office and the studios and the people making movies about what they could include and what they could not include to keep to that arduous and horrible agreement. But Frenchie, I think, is a great character and really is a feminist icon in some ways. She stands up, she does things on her own terms. She mocks men, but fondly. Hasn't got a nasty edge to her, particularly you can see in that bit with Frenchie, where Frenchie and Callahan, where she's mocking him, but she's not mocking him in a nasty way at all. She's having fun with him as much as at his expense. And he kind of enjoys playing the game as well, thinking that he's going to prevail. So there is that kind of nice relationship there. It's never one where Callahan, who is very devoted to Lilybell, is at all attracted to Frenchie in that way. But he is kind of ensorcelled by her charm and thinks that he will achieve something if he beats her at a poker game, where all the odds are stacked against him because she doesn't necessarily play a straight deck in that. So, I like the movie in a lot of ways. I like the name of the town, Bottleneck, because that's a very important part of the plot. The reason why Kent is buying up all the ranches is the town is in a bottleneck valley where a lot of the cattle for the area are driven through. And if he owns all of the land in there, he can charge people to come through the valley and across his land when they bring their cattle on a cattle drive, and he's charging 25 cents a head. And in the last year, it says in the movie, 350,000 cattle came through, so they're going to make a lot of money if Kent can get the land across the valley and then charge for it. So that's part of the plot line there. The movie does end on a really interesting note too, with the bad guys lining up against the good guy and lining up against the townspeople in a kind of creative and fun way. But again, it does have that note of sadness where, okay, I'm doing the spoiler. Frenchie catches a bullet. And that is only there for one reason at all, and that is to keep the Hays Code happy. It's not there for any reason intrinsic to the plot line. Frenchie and Tom Destry riding off into the sunset together would have been a perfectly logical ending to this movie. But it's not one that the movie's given the opportunity to provide. Having said that, it's a lot of fun. You get Marlene Dietrich singing "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have" and having a lot of fun and just basically going to town and making the most out of this film. You've got the pre-war James Stewart. Now, I'm saying pre-war for a very specific reason. James Stewart was in Bomber Command during World War II and did a lot of bombing raids in Europe and saw a lot of action during the war and saw people die and all of those things that go along with that. And when he came back from the war, he was older, of course, but he was also, the roles he played became darker over time. There were a whole bunch of them in the 50s where he's not playing the unambiguously nice leading man. I mean, you've only got to look at two of the Hitchcocks that he did in the 1950s, being Vertigo and Rear Window, to see that there was a complexity and a moral ambiguity to the roles he played at that time. But in Destry Rides Again, you really don't get that at all. He's playing it dead straight, tongue-in-cheek. People are seeing him as a bit effeminate because he carves napkin rings out of wood and doesn't use a gun. And when he first gets off the stage, he's holding a parasol and a canary in a cage for a lady who's on the stagecoach. So people do get that wrong impression. There's a little bit of Zorro in that. When Don Diego comes across as a very effeminate fop, there's a little touch of that in the way that the townsfolk start treating Destry until he proves himself. But it's a good fun western. I hadn't seen it before. I'm not sure why it never hit my radar, but it didn't for some reason. And I did like it. Of the six movies I got in this box set, it's the most fun and the most interesting one of the lot. And also, the smaller actors do get that chance to shine. Misha Auer is a lot of fun playing Callahan, who's not really Callahan. Charles Werniger does have a lot of fun with it. Alan Jenkins playing one of Kent's sidekicks, Jip. One of the other things I found out about this movie, which was kind of interesting, is there was a stage musical of it done in the late 1950s, which was successful. It's the weird thing is it was successful and went around hundreds of performances, but it's become kind of an unknown musical in some ways. I think there are a lot of other musicals in the late 1950s that were on Broadway that overshadowed it. Things like My Fair Lady and West Side Story and all those kind of things that were really large at the time. And Destry Rides Again, the musical, didn't really get a look in. And the casting on that was kind of interesting too, because Destry was played by Andy Griffiths and Frenchie was played by somebody who people might know from other musicals, Dolores Gray, who was in It's Always Fair Weather and Kismet and musicals like that. The soundtrack of it's really hard to find. I found one track off the soundtrack, and it's not one of the better songs. But there, I'm really kind of, if anybody can steer me to a free copy of the soundtrack to the Broadway musical of Destry Rides Again, I'd be very grateful, because I want to play the soundtrack out and just see how it plays as compared to other musicals of the time. The stage version musical doesn't end as badly as the movie. It doesn't have the restriction of the Hays Code. And so Destry and Frenchie do get a happy ending in that one. But having said that, recommended Western. I think it would be a great Western companion to watch back-to-back with Blazing Saddles, because you will get the idea of where Lili von Stupp came from and the thing that Madeleine Kahn in that movie is satirizing, being Frenchie, played by Marlene Dietrich in Destry Rides Again. And possibly a little bit of Marlene Dietrich in the second movie that we're going to talk about, Rancho Notorious. But anyway, that's about it to say about Destry Rides Again. Again, it's been fucked up by the Hays Code, as many, many things were at the time. And anybody who thinks that the Hays Code was ever a good idea really needs to have their ass kicked from here to the fence, because there were so many missed opportunities and so many missed films that could have been made so much better had the people make them not had these arduous moral handcuffs on when they made the film. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the second movie, which is Fritz Lang's Rancho Notorious, which when I first looked at it, I didn't like, but then I read up on it a little bit and I watched it again, and it has grown on me very much, and I'm going to tell you why after I take a break.
Here I stand, the goddess of desire, set men on fire, I have this power. Morning, noon and night, it's drink and dancing, some quick romancing, and then a shower. Stage door johnnies constantly surround me, they always hound me with one request. Who can satisfy their lustful habit? I'm not a rabbit, I need some rest. I'm tired, sick and tired of love. I've had my fill of love from below and above. Tired of being admired, tired of love uninspired. Let's face it, I'm tired. I've been with thousands of men again and again. They promised the moon. Always coming and going and going and coming, and always too soon. Bye, girls. I'm tired. Tired of playing the game. Ain't it a crying shame? I'm so tired. God damn it, I'm exhausted. Hello, cowboy. What's your name?
Tex, ma'am.
Tex, ma'am. Tell me, Tex, ma'am, are you in show business?
Nope.
Well, then why don't you get your friggin' feet up? Hello, handsome. Is that a 10-gallon hat? Or are you just enjoying the show? Everything below the waist is kaput.
That was Madeline Carney's Ludwig von Stupp from Blazing Saddles singing I'm Tired. I just took a look and I haven't done Blazing Saddles for a Paleo Cinema podcast, which seems to be a bit of an oversight, something overlooked by me. Because I could probably do a couple of back-to-back Mel Brooks films and have a lot of fun. Maybe the producers on Blazing Saddles or something like that for a future podcast. So what I've just done in that break while I was listening to Madeline Kahn having a lot of fun there is add it to the list. I think the producers on Blazing Saddles might be a bit of fun. And with a co-host might be a bit of fun too. So that's definitely on the list. And by the way, there are a couple of people from the Patreon campaign that I owe co-hosting roles to. I will be getting around to it once I get my shit together. So please don't think that I've deliberately snubbed you. It will happen, and we will do a couple of movies that have been suggested as well. So, yep, on to Fritz Lang's 1952 it is a crime movie in a sense, crime/western Rancho Notorious, starring Marlena Dietrich, Arthur Kennedy, Mel Ferrer, Gloria Henry, William Frawley's in there as well, Jack Elam, and George Reeves, who played Superman in the Superman TV series, is in there as well. Now, the story is fairly simple in essence. Vern Haskell, a rancher, sets out to avenge the rape and murder of his fiancée when she's killed during a robbery in an assay office. His revenge leads him to Chuckaluck, Alta Keen, played by Marlena Dietrich's ranch set up to hide criminals, and he finds more than he bargained for. That's what it says here in the IMDb. And that's pretty much it. Now, the structure of the movie is kind of weird. There's a theme song sung at the start of it called Chuckaluck, sung by a guy called William Lee. And it can sound kind of hokey. At the first listening and the first viewing of the film, and I only seen this for the first time a week ago, it really does sound intrusive and a bit twee and silly and really badly done. But I then read something about it which kind of opened my eyes to it. I'll play a little bit of the song before I tell you what that is.
Now the road that goes to Chuckaluck
leads to a western jail, and behind the bars is an outlaw who knows the Chuckalut Trail. There's crooked politicians in the very next cell, safely locked away. It's an angry town, all closed down to vote on election day. But here's a man with a crazy plan, a plan that will not wait. He'll trick his way inside that jail to reach his goal of hate, murder and revenge.
Okay, I'm going to tell you why that is better than it sounds at first sound. Somebody in a review I read of this film mentioned Bertolt Brecht, and when I kind of re-examined that theme music and the kind of narration slash song that goes throughout the movie, the more I thought of it as a kind of cowboy parallel to a lot of the kind of chorus work that's done on in Brecht plays like the Threepenny Opera. The song in this movie acts exactly the same way, reinforcing the themes of the movie, as Bertolt Brecht's music and song does in the Threepenny Opera. It serves the same purpose, which is to kind of emphasize the theme of hate, murder, and revenge. And that, I think that works really well. I think it's something that it's a bold move to make, and it uses something that already pre-existed in cowboy movies, being the kind of theme music and the cowboy troubadour kind of thing, for a bit of a different purpose. And once you look at it in that light, it does enhance the movie surprisingly much. Now, I'll get a few bits of trivia about the film out of the way now, and then we can kind of move on to looking at a few other bits of it. The main villain in the film, Kinch, doesn't get mentioned in the credits. The actor who played him, Lloyd Goff, if you look through the credits of Rancho Notorious, you won't see his name there because he was blacklisted during the Red Scare in Hollywood in the 50s. So even though he is basically the engine that drives the plot, he's the person who assaults, well, rapes and murders the fiancée of Arthur Kennedy's character, Vern Haskell, whose name is Beth Forbes, played by Gloria Henry. The character just doesn't appear in the credits for that stupid reason that he was blacklisted. Imagine that happening now where, say, Michael Shannon didn't turn up in Man of Steel because he'd been blacklisted, even though he was playing General Zod. It's at that level of stupidity in this film that they removed a guy who did a very good job of the role. I mean, it's not a major role compared to a lot of the others, but he does play it across very well and is worthy of having his name on the film. And unfortunately, he doesn't for that reason. I think it should be added in now. I'm not usually a big fan of retrofitting things to films, but I think that Lloyd Goff deserves to have his name on this movie. But the other actors you've got in there, we had Frenchie in Destry Rides Again, but we also have a Frenchie in Rancho Notorious, Frenchie Fairmont, played by Mel Ferrer, who was for a time married to Audrey Hepburn, which is not really relevant to the movie. But yeah, he plays a kind of gunslinger, dandy, and Alter's partner in a lot of ways. When she, well, I'll give you a bit of background that isn't in the précis that I gave you. And as Vern travels looking for the person who raped and killed his fiancée, he finds more and more stories about a woman who started out as a bar girl. Her name's Alter Keane, played by Marlene Dietrich. And as we get the stories, we get flashbacks into Alter's previous life, a lot of which resembles a little bit Frenchie from Destry Rides Again, the same kind of bar girl. You see her at one stage playing bar games, riding on the back of a guy. You see her at other times singing and all sorts of other bits and pieces. But as we get closer and closer to Vern reaching Chuckalut, which is the name of the ranch that Alter owns, the closer and closer we get to contemporary times. We get to the time set up in the main narrative of the movie, and we see her being disillusioned by that kind of life and not really giving a shit anymore, until eventually she's working for a guy called Baldy, played by William Frawley, Baldy Gunder, played by William Frawley, who runs a kind of cheap little casino with a chuckaluck game. Chuckaluck's kind of like a roulette, but with a wheel, like a chocolate wheel, instead of a roulette wheel, a vertical wheel rather than a horizontal wheel. Anyway, William Frawley, people know for playing Fred Mertz in I Love Lucy for a very long time. And he's kind of cool in here as Baldy. He does a nice little character role in that. But the other ensemble in there is pretty good too. We've got Jack Elam in there, the guy with those funny eyes. Cowboy actor for a long time. He turns up in a lot of 1950s westerns, particularly ones that Anthony Mann directed and that James Stewart starred in. He's in two or three of those. George Reeves in there, just at the time he was doing the start of the Superman TV series, playing Wilson, one of the people who is hiding in Chuckaluck because Alter sets up this ranch, apart from it being a horse ranch, she sets it up as a hideout for robbers on the lam. They give her 10% of their money and then they can stay there until things cool off and then leave again. And she's got an elaborate system set up so that if posses come through, she's got a way of hiding the guys out until the posses leave. So George Reeves plays Wilson. Wilson's got a scar on his face, which he says is done by a bobcat. And as Vern traces back through various people to finding Alter, who knows the person who raped and killed his fiancée, as you get closer and closer to that, the more morally ambiguous Vern becomes. Part of the trail leads him to a barbershop where there's a guy at a barbershop and there's a really mean fight in a barbershop between Arthur Kennedy and one of the other actors, which really is a rough-and-tumble fight, particularly given the fact that you can find things in barbershops that are very, very dangerous. And in fact, a straight razor is used at one stage. And there's really a genuine tension and suspense in that fight scene, as there are in a couple of others. But the movie, this is one of the problems with the movies, and again, you still got the production code and the Hays code running things in Hollywood, not to mention the blacklist that knocked Lloyd Goff's name out of the movie. But you still got that there, and you can see Fritz Lang kind of pushing against that in a lot of ways. For instance, there's a tiny bit of dialogue where the doctor finds Beth, the fiancée of Vern Haskell, after she's been murdered and assaulted by Kinch. And there's this little bit of dialogue there that really does convey a lot by using kind of a bleak language.
Vern, I don't know how to tell you this, but she wasn't spared anything.
Which is kind of subtle, but not subtle as well. And there's a really nice little shot that Fritz Lang does after that bit of dialogue and after a couple of other bits where Vern borrows a gun from a friend and ties it, basically cinches it around his waist, indicating that he's going to be going out for revenge. And there's a scene where they go from the face of Beth down across. She's got some bloodstains on the front of her dress, down to her hand, which is like draped dead on the floor, and the cracked fingernails of her hand showing that she put up a struggle. And within the production code and Hays code and all that kind of thing, it really is a subtle way for Fritz Lang to obliquely indicate what's occurred without being blatantly obvious, which they weren't able to do because of that stupid production code. He manages to convey the horror of the rape without kind of prurient violence, and that in itself is an admirable thing. And this movie was made in 1952, so Marlene Dietrich was 51 at the time. There were some problems that she had with the cinematographer Hal Moore, who'd also done Destry Rides Again. He tried to quit the movie because Dietrich insisted that he achieve for her, and I'm reading this off IMDb, achieve for her greater youth through lighting than he felt was possible. So basically she was an aging actress, but she wanted him to light her so that she looked a lot younger. But I don't think that's quite right for the role. And I think that may have been a kind of – there are two things there. The first thing is that women of a certain age in Hollywood really did have a hard time, and it was difficult for them to accept that they were aging because they knew it would limit their possibilities for certain roles. And on the other side as well, there were a limitation of roles and for women above a certain age, and there were tricks of kind of, you know, tightening the skin using tapes under wigs and using filters on the camera lenses and all that kind of thing to make women of a certain age appear younger. But they, with the women who were aging in Hollywood, particularly the big stars, were keenly aware of the fact that their days at a certain level of fame and a certain level of being able to determine their own fate in the movie industry was numbered by the fact that they were getting older. But that parallels the theme of the movie in a sense, where you see Alter playing around and being the kind of winsome and wayward bar girl, and then slowly being disillusioned by that lifestyle until she meets Frenchie when she's just got the sack from Baldy Gunder's casino and throws the last $20 on the chuckaluck table and ends up winning a lot of money, which enables her to set up the ranch and basically determine her own fate to a big extent with the partnership of Frenchie, the male Frenchie, not the female Frenchie. And this makes it hard having the two Frenchies in the two different movies. So Frenchie Fairmont, played by Mel Ferrer. As Vern gets darker and darker and basically breaks people out of jail and commits crimes and becomes quite a violent and amoral person himself, he gets closer and closer to reaching Chuckaluck and Alter Keane. And the interesting thing about the name there, Alter, it kind of denotes worship. And the last thing the character of Alter Keane wants is to be worshipped by men. She wants to live a life on her own terms, and she is in love with Frenchie Fairmont, but she doesn't want to be worshipped, so the name's kind of an ironic comment as well, as much as anything. But anyway, as he gets closer and closer to Alter, he gets closer and closer to her story being up to contemporary times in the narratives that people tell him, as he's trying to find Chuckaluck, because he knows that the guy who killed and raped his fiancée is in Chuckaluck. And I'm explaining that badly, and I do apologise. But the interesting thing is that when Vern finally meets Alter, she's wearing men's clothing, she's got greasy arms and smudged face and all that kind of thing, and doesn't look anything like this kind of mythical bar girl that Vern has heard about all through his travels, which kind of is a nice way of Fritz Lang to play it too. And Vern never really, to a certain extent, is in love with Alter. He's playing her, and he tries to flirt with her and seduce her to try to get more information. Now, there are a bunch of men holed up at Chuckaluck, one of whom is the rapist. We know who it is because we've seen him at the start of the film. It's Kinch, played by Lloyd Goff, but Vern doesn't know which one it is and misjudges it several times and really doesn't know who this man that he's out to kill really is. And that builds up a really nice tension in the film. At some stage he thinks it's Wilson, played by George Reeves, because he's a ladies' man and kind of bragging about his conquests and things like that. And, he not only is Vern confused by the fact that his moral compass has totally gone out the window, but he's also confused because he doesn't know who is being friendly to be friendly and who's being friendly to try to put him off so that he doesn't know who they really are. So there's that ambiguity. There are a whole bunch of different levels here. There's the dynamic between Frenchie Fairmont and Alter and Vern, as Vern tries to basically flirt with Alter for information. And Frenchie's in love with her as well, and Alter's kind of attracted to Vern. So you've got that triangle there. You've also got the other dynamic of Vern trying to find out who killed his fiancée and eventually getting a clue from Alter almost against her will. And then you've got that you know, the person he's become really being not being a person that his fiancée would have cared about. He's become a kind of amoral revenge machine and really has lost his way in a lot more ways than one. So this is a fairly complex film, even though the narrative is fairly straightforward. It's a revenge story, and Marlene Dietrich's character is almost an icon, an altar in a sense, rather than somebody who's the central to the plot. She's a source of clues for the main narrative, which is Verne's quest for revenge. But on the other hand, she's also has her own story in parallel with that, of the changes in her life brought about by the life she's led and her disillusion with that, and then finally finding a place of sanctuary and then finding out ultimately that it's not really a place of sanctuary at all. So Fritz Lang's quite complicated with this film and makes a story which isn't really a Western in some senses. It's almost a film noir. It's a revenge story, and it could have been told. It could be told in a whole bunch of different ways. It's a story that doesn't have anything specifically Western about it. It's not about the exploration and the opening up of the frontier. It's not about fighting Indians. It's not about that. It's about violence and crime and hatred, and how being a victim of crime, if you'd let it, can turn you into a much worse person than you were in the first place. So, yeah, that it sits, on retrospect, it sits more easily as a noir for me than it does as a Western in some ways. But nonetheless, it's really worthwhile seeing. Every time I see a new Fritz Lang movie, and I haven't seen them all yet, I've still got a few to go, the more I'm impressed with that moral complexity that it brings to even the simplest of movies, and the way that he thinks outside the box rather than painting by the numbers. And that's a mixed metaphor if ever I've heard one. But I think that Dietrich is great in this. The only roles she had better than this later on would probably have been in Witnesses for the Prosecution, which I talked about previously. But she really is good in this one. And her uncertainty as an aging actress in this kind of film works really well to kind of inhabit the uncertainties and the changes in the life of the character she plays. So that kind of works in a positive way towards the story. Arthur Kennedy, I think, is a good actor, but I'm not sure that he's perfect for this role. I think that he's always struck me as more of a second lead kind of guy rather than somebody who's the kind of narrative driver for a film like this. Mel Ferrer's pretty good, but I don't think he's better than he has to be in the film. The character actors really carry this in some ways, and they even Wilson, played by George Rees, with his incredibly familiar face and big kind of Superman physique, inhabits the role really well. He makes it like it's a character of its time rather than, hey, look, there's Superman wearing a funny shirt and having scars on his face. And I think he was quite good in this one. But just to get back to the main premise of the movie, it is a good, solid thing. I think watching it twice really did help me a lot. The first time I could kind of look at it as kind of a second-rate Western and what the fuck's going on here. But thinking about it more, researching it more, and just letting it be what it is and not trying to fit it into a slot that it doesn't fit into really has worked well to understanding the movie. So that's about it for that. I'm going to take another short break and have a drink of water because my throat's starting to feel a little bit dry. And when I get back, I'll just wrap up the podcast. Okay, there's no feedback this time around. I've got a little bit for The Martian Drive-In next time around, so that's all good. But there's nothing for Paleo Cinema, so I'm sorry about that. People, if you were hoping to get some feedback, and if you were, why didn't you give me some? But I really should think of a movie question to finish up on the podcast with. Okay, here we go. If you could have a movie starring any two stars, a male and a female star, from any time in movie history, what movie remake would it be, and who would you have starring in it? Now, it can be any movie from any time. It can be, you could even have, you know, any movie actors that even went alive at the same time. So what movie stars would you have in a remake? Two stars, one movie from any time during movie history. I'll leave you with that one. That was just off the top of my head. So anyway, I'm going to be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. We'll see if whether I get a guest or not. May well be able to do that. If not, I'll fly solo again, but we'll find a couple of other interesting things to do. I've added the two Mel Brooks movies to the list of movies to do for the podcast, so that's got to got something out of this podcast anyway. I recommend the two movies, of course, Rancho Notorious and Destry Rides. Again, if you haven't seen them or haven't seen them in a while, they're definitely worth checking out. Anyway, I'll be back in a week's time with another Martian Drive-In podcast. You can go over to marsdrivein.blogspot.com to check that out. And in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. In the meantime, everybody look after yourselves. Take care, have fun, enjoy your movies. And I will talk at you again very, very soon.